Black Heart and White Heart, a Zulu idol. Dedication. To the memory of the child Nata Burnham, who bound all to her end, while her father cut his way through the hordes of the Ingobo Regiment, perished of the hardships of war at Bulawayo on 19 May, 1896, I dedicate these tales, and more particularly the last, that of a faith which triumphed over savagery and death. H. Rider Haggard. Ditchingham, Author's Note. Of the three stories that comprise this volume, 1, The Wizard, A Tale of Victorious Faith, first appeared some years ago as a Christmas annual. Another, Elissa, is an attempt, difficult enough owing to the scantiness of the material left to us by time, to recreate the life of the ancient Phoenician Zimbabwe, whose ruins still stand in Rhodesia, and, with the addition of the necessary love story, to suggest circumstances such as might have brought about or accompanied its fall at the hands of the surrounding savage tribes. The third, Black Heart and White Heart, is a story of the courtship, trials and final union of a pair of Zulu lovers in the time of King Cetshwayo. This text was prepared from a volume published in 1900 titled Black Heart and White Heart, and Other Stories, J.B. Black Heart and White Heart. A Zulu Idol. Chapter 1. Philip Haddon and King Cetshwayo. At the date of our introduction to him, Philip Haddon was a transport rider and trader in the Zulu. Still on the right side of 40, in appearance he was singularly handsome, tall, dark, upright, with keen eyes, short pointed beard, curling hair and clear-cut features. His life had been varied, and there were passages in it which he did not narrate even to his most intimate friends. He was of gentle birth, however, and it was said that he had received a public school and university education in England. At any rate, he could quote the classics with aptitude on occasion, an accomplishment which, coupled with his refined voice and a bearing not altogether common in the wild places of the world, had earned for him among his rough companions the sobriquet of the Prince. However these things may have been, it is certain that he had emigrated to Natal under a cloud, and equally certain that his relatives at home were content to take no further interest in his fortunes. During the 15 or 16 years which he had spent in or about the colony, Haddon followed many trades, and did no good at any of them. A clever man, of agreeable and prepossessing manner, he always found it easy to form friendships and to secure a fresh start in life. But, by degrees, the friends were seized with a vague distrust of him, and, after a period of more or less application, he himself would close the opening that he had made by a sudden disappearance from the locality, leaving behind him a doubtful reputation and some bad debts. Before the beginning of this story of the most remarkable episodes in his life, Philip Haddon was engaged for several years in transport riding, that is, in carrying goods on ox wagons from Durban or Maritzburg to various points in the interior. A difficulty such as had more than once confronted him in the course of his career, led to his temporary abandonment of this means of earning a livelihood. On arriving at the little frontier town of Utrecht in the Transvaal, in charge of 2 wagon loads of mixed goods consigned to a storekeeper there, it was discovered that out of 6 cases of brandy 5 were missing from his wagon. Haddon explained the matter by throwing the blame upon his Kaffir boys, but the storekeeper, a rough-tongued man, openly called him a thief and refused to pay the freight on any of the load. From words the two men came to blows, knives were drawn, and before anybody could interfere the storekeeper received a nasty wound in his side. That night, without waiting till the matter could be inquired into by the Landdrostor magistrate, Haddon slipped away, and trekked back into Natal as quickly as his oxen would travel. Feeling that even here he was not safe, he left one of his wagons at Newcastle, loaded up the other with Kaffir goods, such as blankets, calico, and hardware, and crossed into Zululand, where in those days no sheriff's officer would be likely to follow him. Being well acquainted with the language and customs of the natives, he did good trade with them, and soon found himself possessed of some cash and a small herd of cattle, which he received in exchange for his wares. Meanwhile, news reached him that the man whom he had injured still vowed vengeance against him, and was in communication with the authorities in Natal. These reasons making his return to civilization undesirable for the moment, and further business being impossible until he could receive a fresh supply of trade stuff, Haddon, like a wise man, turned his thoughts to pleasure. Sending his cattle and wagon over the border to be left in charge of a native headman with whom he was friendly, he went on foot to Ulundi to obtain permission from the king, Cetshwayo, to hunt game in his country. Somewhat to his surprise, the Indunas or headmen received him courteously, for Haddon's visit took place within a few months of the outbreak of the Zulu War in 1878, when Cetshwayo was already showing unfriendliness to the English traders and others, though why the king did so they knew not. On the occasion of his first and last interview with Cetshwayo, Haddon got a hint of the reason. It happened thus. On the second morning after his arrival at the Royal Kraal, A messenger came to inform him that the elephant whose tread shook the earth had signified that it was his pleasure to see him. Accordingly, he was led through the thousands of huts and across the great place to the little enclosure where Cetshwayo, a royal-looking Zulu seated on a stool, and wearing a kaross of leopard skins, was holding an indaba, or conference, surrounded by his counselors. The Induna who had conducted him to the august presence went down upon his hands and knees, and, uttering the royal salute of Bayet, crawled forward to announce that the white man was waiting. "Let him wait," said the king angrily, and, turning, he continued the discussion with his counselors. Now, as has been said, Hatton thoroughly understood Zulu, and, when from time to time the king raised his voice, some of the words he spoke reached his ear. "What?" Cetshwayo said, to a wizened and aged man who seemed to be pleading with him earnestly, "am I a dog that these white hyenas should hunt me thus? Is not the land mine, and was it not my father's before me? Are not the people mine to save or to slay? I tell you that I will stamp out these little white men, my impis shall eat them up. I have said." Again the withered aged man interposed, evidently in the character of a peacemaker. Hatton could not hear his talk, but he rose and pointed towards the sea, while from his expressive gestures and sorrowful mien, he seemed to be prophesying disaster should a certain course of action be followed. For a while the king listened to him, then he sprang from his seat, his eyes literally ablaze with rage. "Hearken," he cried to the counselor, "I have guessed it for long, and now I am sure of it. You are a traitor. You are some Sue's dog, and the dog of the natal government, and I will not keep another man's dog to bite me in my own house. Take him away." "Sir Theophilus Shepstance." A slight involuntary murmur rose from the ring of Indunas, but the old man never flinched, not even when the soldiers, who presently would murder him, came and seized him roughly. For a few seconds, perhaps five, he covered his face with the corner of the kaross he wore, then he looked up and spoke to the king in a clear voice. "O king," he said, "I am a very old man, as a youth I served under Chaka the lion, and I heard his dying prophecy of the coming of the white man. Then the white men came, and I fought for Dingaan at the Battle of the Blood River. They slew Dingaan, and for many years I was the counselor of Panda, your father. I stood by you, O king, at the Battle of the Tugela, when its gray waters were turned to red with the blood of Umbalazi your brother, and of the tens of thousands of his people. Afterwards I became your counselor, O king, and I was with you when Sumsu set the crown upon your head and you made promises to Sumsu, promises that you have not kept. Now you are weary of me, and it is well, for I am very old, and doubtless my talk is foolish, as it chances to the old. Yet I think that the prophecy of Chaka, your great uncle, will come true, and that the white men will prevail against you and that through them you shall find your death. I would that I might have stood in one more battle and fought for you, O king, since fight you will, but the end which you choose is for me the best end. Sleep in peace, O king, and farewell. But yet." The royal salute of the Zulus. For a space there was silence, a silence of expectation while men waited to hear the tyrant reverse his judgment. But it did not please him to be merciful, or the needs of policy outweighed his pity. "Take him away," he repeated. Then, with a slow smile on his face and one word, "good night," upon his lips, supported by the arm of a soldier, the old warrior and statesman shuffled forth to the place of death. Hatton watched and listened in amazement not unmixed with fear. "If he treats his own servants like this, what will happen to me?" he reflected. "We English must have fallen out of favor since I left Natal. I wonder whether he means to make war on us or what? If so, this isn't my place." Just then the king, who had been gazing moodily at the ground, chanced to look up. "Bring the stranger here," he said. Hatton heard him, and coming forward offered Cetshwayo his hand in as cool and nonchalant a manner as he could command. Somewhat to his surprise it was accepted. "At least, white man," said the king, glancing at his visitor's tall spare form and cleanly cut face, "you are no Umphagozan, low fellow, you are of the blood of chiefs." "Yes, king," answered Hatton, with a little sigh, "I am of the blood of chiefs. What do you want in my country, white man?"
"Very little, king. I have been trading here, as I dare say you have heard, and have sold all my goods. Now I ask your leave to hunt buffalo, and other big game, for a while before I return to Natal."
"I cannot grant it," answered Cetshwayo, "you are a spy sent by Sumsu, or by the Queen's Induna in Natal. Get you gone."
"Indeed," said Hatton, with a shrug of his shoulders, "then I hope that Sumsu, or the Queen's Induna, or both of them, will pay me when I return to my own country. Meanwhile I will obey you because I must, but I should first like to make you a present."
"What present?" asked the king. I want no presents. We are rich here, white man.
So be it, king. It was nothing worthy of your taking, only a rifle.
A rifle, white man? Where is it?
Without. I would have brought it, but your servants told me that it is death to come armed before the elephant who shakes the earth.
Cetshwayo frowned, for the note of sarcasm did not escape his quick hair.
Let this white man's offering be brought, I will consider the thing.
Instantly the Induna who had accompanied Haddon darted to the gateway, running with his body bent so low that it seemed as though at every step he must fall upon his face. Presently he returned with the weapon in his hand and presented it to the king, holding it so that the muzzle was pointed straight at the royal breast.
I crave leave to say, O elephant, remarked Haddon in a drawling voice, that it might be well to command your servant to lift the mouth of that gun from your heart.
Why? Asked the king.
Only because it is loaded, and at full cock, O elephant, who probably desires to continue to shake the earth.
At these words the elephant uttered a sharp exclamation, and rolled from his stool in a most unkingly manner, whilst the terrified Induna, springing backwards, contrived to touch the trigger of the rifle and discharge a bullet through the exact spot that a second before had been occupied by his monarch's head.
Let him be taken away, shouted the incensed king from the ground, but long before the words had passed his lips the Induna, with a cry that the gun was bewitched, had cast it down and fled at full speed through the gate.
He has already taken himself away, suggested Haddon, while the audience tittered.
No, king, do not touch it rashly, it is a repeating rifle.
Look, and lifting the Winchester, he fired the four remaining shots in quick succession into the air, striking the top of a tree at which he aimed with every one of them.
Wow, it is wonderful! Said the company in astonishment.
Has the thing finished? Asked the king.
For the present it has, answered Haddon. Look at it.
Cetshwayo took the repeater in his hand, and examined it with caution, swinging the muzzle horizontally in an exact line with the stomachs of some of his most eminent Indunas, who shrank to this side and that as the barrel was brought to bear on them.
See what cowards they are, white man, said the king with indignation, they fear lest there should be another bullet in this gun.
Yes, answered Haddon, they are cowards indeed. I believe that if they were seated on stools they would tumble off them just as it chanced to your majesty to do just now.
Do you understand the making of guns, white man? Asked the king hastily, while the Indunas one and all turned their heads, and contemplated the fence behind them.
No, king, I cannot make guns, but I can mend them.
If I paid you well, white man, would you stop here at my kraal, and mend guns for me? Asked Cetshwayo anxiously.
It might depend on the pay, answered Haddon, but for a while I am tired of work, and wish to rest. If the king gives me the permission to hunt for which I asked, and men to go with me, then when I return perhaps we can bargain on the matter. If not, I will bid the king farewell, and journey to Natal.
In order to make report of what he has seen and learned here, muttered Cetshwayo.
At this moment the talk was interrupted, for the soldiers who had led away the old Induna returned at speed, and prostrated themselves before the king.
Is he dead? He asked.
He has traveled the king's bridge, they answered grimly, he died singing a song of praise of the king.
Good, said Cetshwayo, that stone shall hurt my feet no more.
Go, tell the tale of its casting away to Samsu and to the queen's Induna in Natal, he added with bitter emphasis.
Baba! Hear our father speak. Listen to the rumbling of the elephant, said the Indunas taking the point, while one bolder than the rest added, soon we will tell them another tale, the white talking ones, a red tale, a tale of spears, and the regiments shall sing it in their ears.
At the words an enthusiasm caught hold of the listeners, as the sudden flame catches hold of dry grass. They sprang up, for the most of them were seated on their haunches, and stamping their feet upon the ground in unison, repeated. Indaba Ivamwu, Indaba Yimakanta Lizo Dunyuzwang Ampin Labeni Yaho. A red tail. A red tail. A tale of spears, and the impis shall sing it in their ears.
One of them, indeed, a great fierce-faced fellow, drew near to Haddon and shaking his fist before his eyes, fortunately being in the royal presence he had no assegai, shouted the sentences at him.
The king saw that the fire he had lit was burning too fiercely.
Silence, he thundered in the deep voice for which he was remarkable, and instantly each man became as if he were turned to stone, only the echoes still answered back, and the impis shall sing it in their ears, in their ears.
I am growing certain that this is no place for me, thought Haddon, if that scoundrel had been armed he might have temporarily forgotten himself.
Hello! Who's this?
Just then there appeared through the gate of the fence a splendid specimen of the Zulu race. The man, who was about 35 years of age, was arrayed in a full war dress of a captain of the Imsaitu regiment. From the circlet of otter skin on his brow rose his crest of plumes, round his middle, arms and knees hung the long fringes of black oxtails, and in one hand he bore a little dancing shield, also black in color. The other was empty, since he might not appear before the king bearing arms. In countenance the man was handsome, and though just now they betrayed some anxiety, his eyes were genial and honest, and his mouth sensitive. In height he must have measured 6'2", yet he did not strike the observer as being tall, perhaps because of his width of chest and the solidity of his limbs, that were in curious contrast to the delicate and almost womanish hands and feet which so often marked the Zulu of noble blood. In short, the man was what he seemed to be, a savage gentleman of birth, dignity and courage. In company with him was another man plainly dressed in a moocha and a blanket, whose grizzled hair showed him